With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. But are your bills accurate? Well, it's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help you. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. So to save, visit HealthLock.com today. That's HealthLock.com today.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. My guest today has worked in the best restaurants in the world, taught thousands of hours of culinary technique, authored over 30 cookbooks, and at the age of 88, shows no signs of slowing down. Legendary French chef Jacques Pepin. Chef Pepin has enjoyed, by all accounts, a most extraordinary life and career. By 22, he was the personal chef for French President Charles de Gaulle. In 1959, he immigrated to America and worked at Le Pavillon, the best French restaurant in New York City, before moving to Howard Johnson's. His next frontier was the American home, instructing audiences on proper French cooking methods. This began with his cookbooks, including the groundbreaking La Technique, and then through multiple PBS series like Today's Gourmet and Cooking at Home. Here, Chef Pepin taught the home chef both the basics for everyday meals and experimentation with gourmet flourishes. His most recent cookbook is called Jacques Pepin Cooking My Way, Recipes and Techniques for Economical Cooking. I wanted to know how growing up in a small town in France with his mother working in restaurants, put him on the path to where he is today.
Well, we were in the farm country. We had a little restaurant just outside of Lyon. You know, life was quite different. I mean, I turned 88 yesterday, so I'm talking about over 80 years ago. Life was relatively easy. My father was a cabinet maker. My mother was a cook. So my choice in life was, I'm a cabinet maker, I'm a cook. We didn't have the telephone, we didn't have radio or television, of course, any of this. So life was probably much easier for a kid than it is now. And certainly we took the dog, my brother and I, and go into the forest and all that on our day off. And the parents never, you know, we came back at night and no one worried about where you were. It was quite different than now.
And did your father take his cabinet making practice out into the country with you just outside of Lyon, or did he stay in the city and make his products?
No, he did that in the country, but after he gave up anyway at some point to work in the restaurant with my mother. But my father was a cabinet maker, his father was, his brother was, what we call in France ébéniste, from the word ebony. So it's fancy cabinet maker, you know, he used noble wood like cherries, oak and so forth. Never use any nail. It's always, you know, cut and joint and glue and a sculpture on the wood. It was that type of work, you know, Louis XVI, Louis XVII kind of furniture. I still have a couple of pieces from him, actually, here in my house.
Now, your mother got into the restaurant business when you were how old?
Well, after I was born, because I have exactly 20 years difference with my mother. I mean, she got married, I think she was 17 and a half, then had my brother with a year and a half older than me, and another one. So she got into the restaurant business slightly before the war. She was a waitress, working different restaurants, start helping in the kitchen. It was pretty common in France. I mean, in the family in France, I count 12 restaurants, 12 of them run by women. My two aunts, a sister-in-law, cousin, a niece, a mother, they all had. I was actually the first male to go into that business. And those kind of formidable women were not very impressed by me. I remember when I was the chef to the president in France, go back down to Lyon, go to my aunt who had a little restaurant. I get into the kitchen, she throw me out. She said, "You use too much butter, get out of here." They were not very impressed by me.
And who's managing all this enterprise, your mother?
Oh, they didn't have 12 restaurants at the time. I'm right. Calling in general, my aunt had a restaurant in Bourg, another aunt had a restaurant somewhere else. Right. My mother had four restaurants, actually, at some point.
And when, what was it about, I mean, so I'm assuming you feel like you were born to this? There's no way you could escape it? You said cabinet making or cooking.
Right.
But you found the kitchen more seductive, correct?
Absolutely, more exciting, more seductive, and so I went into this. I mean, as I said, the choice was relatively easy for kids at that point. In France, we were supposed to go to school until age 14, which I did at 13, and I took all the exam, you know, at the end of primary school, you have different exams. So I took all of those, and I finished when I was barely 13. So I said, that's it, I'm going into apprenticeship. My older brother became an engineer, so he worked, you know, so it was not the question of me that I had to go to work. That's what I wanted to do. So, I went to school later. So,
do you think that people, I mean, there's next to no association between what I do for a living and what you do for a living, but in the world of acting and theater and so forth, people will often say, I can't make you a good actor, but I can make you a better actor than you were when you walked in the door. But there needs to be some inherent inspiration. Is that same thing true about food and cooking? Do people have to have an inherent gift for that kind of thing?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, for me, I'm talking about professionalism, professional chef. And on a professional chef, I did those books called La Technique, which is an illustrated manual of cooking technique, to know how to bone out a chicken, to poach an egg. And it's not a question of knowing how to do it. It's 11 o'clock and you have 100 people sitting down for lunch. You really have to move. So this is the difference between a professional chef and a home cook, you know, the speed and all that too. So you have to be a good technician to be a chef first. But I know a fair amount of chefs who are good technicians, run a good kitchen, and are relatively lousy cook. The food is all right, but conversely, I know people who cook at home who wouldn't be able to run a restaurant speed and all that too, but food is fantastic, great, you know. So to be a great chef like Thomas Keller or Daniel Boulud, well, you have to be a technician first, but then you have to have other things after, you know. You have to have imagination, talent to bring it to another level, you know, I think.
Eventually, you moved to Paris.
Yes.
And, I don't want to quote the number here because I find this fantastic. You work in many, many, many restaurants during that period, correct?
Close to 100, probably.
How is that possible?
It's possible because I work at the Plaza Athénée in Paris for like 7 years. But my day off, each day off, I work at a different restaurant most of the time, and I have 2 days off a week. There is an organization called La Société des Cuisiniers, Society of the Chefs of Paris, which I was a member. In fact, I don't know why we don't have that in New York, but you go in the morning or your cook doesn't come or whoever doesn't come, they call, they say, I need one cook for the day. So, you know, I will end up like at Macy, you know, Galerie Lafayette, too, and do like 3,000 plates with a piece of salad in between and an egg, you know. And the next time I end up in a 2-star restaurant. And so you never know where the society is going to send you. But that was great experience, you know, of working, because in case like this, It's not like you have to wait for the day to learn the habit of the house. I mean, within 15 minutes you're there, the chef says you got to work. So it's great training, really.
So you have a job in one where you were at Attenay.
Oh, yes.
And you have a job, but you sound like we've had guests on the show who were some of the most legendary sessions musicians in history.
Right.
And it sounds like you have the same kind of thing. You're going to go in for a day and do so. And is the culture there, I don't want to say uniform, but approachable, where you can walk in and you're just accepted? You walk in there, or do you see, are there conflicts with the way things are done sometimes?
No. I mean,
you fit in.
If you work in a job to stay for a couple of years, you may get involved into that type of thing. But when you work for the day, 2 days, no. And remember that at the time, the cook was really at the bottom of the social scale. Any good mother would have wanted her child to marry a lawyer, you know, a doctor, certainly not a cook. So now we are genius. I don't know what happened. At that time, it wasn't the case. So when you went into a restaurant, it was to conform exactly to the habit of that restaurant. It was not to create or do something on your own. In fact, I don't think I ever used a recipe before I came to America. So you work in that place, you learn the taste of that. And those dishes, in a sense, become very visceral, very powerful. I mean, the dishes my mother did as a kid, you know, those tastes will stay with you the rest of your life. And I'll go at the Plaza Athénée in Paris, for example, we did the lobster souffle. We were 48 chefs in the kitchen there. And the 48 of us could have done it, you would never have known who has done it. That was the way it was. Mm-hmm. Until Nouvelle Cuisine in the mid-80s, 90s, when the chefs started creating and doing that type of thing, which is different now.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're a hired chef for the president of France.
Right.
And yes. You work with de Gaulle and some other heads of state. How long were you doing that job?
From 56 and 56 to 58, and the 58, I came here at the end of 59. You know, you have to realize that at the time, again, as I say, the cook, I served people like Eisenhower, Nehru, Tito, Macmillan, those were the head of state. Not anyone ever would call you to get kudo in the dining room. Are you kidding? The cook was in the kitchen, that was it. If anyone came into the kitchen because something was wrong, it was to complain. So I had never had an interview. Well, television barely existed, but with radio or magazine, newspaper, that didn't exist. So it was a different world.
So you're at what is certainly one of the summits of cooking in France. If you're cooking for the head of state there, you have this amazing job. And then when you're done in 58, you move to the United States, correct?
Right. At the end of 1959, I moved. I wasn't married. I had a great job in France. My brother had a restaurant, but I wanted to come to America. America was, still is the golden fleece. So I said, I want to go there for a year, 2 years maybe, learn the language a little bit, see what's going on. I was unattached. So I came here at the end of 59, and I'm still here.
What you see up till then, before you settle in the United States, is it safe to say you have a very restless nature?
Yes, to a certain extent, but that was the world of food, was in a sense very restless, moving from one place to the other to learn, because if you keep your eye open, I mean, I can't work with anyone now and you learn something. You know, you would never have thought of doing it this way, too. Sometimes you learn what not to do, but you learn something. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, coming to America was different. It was the first time I worked at the Pavillon in New York, was considered, you know, the best restaurant here. And it was the first time that I did my day in one shift. In France, we still did two shifts. I start 9 o'clock in the morning until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You're fresh from two to five, go sit down somewhere, and at five you start 5 to 9 or 10. It was standard, you know. So here, I started doing it with one shift. I thought it was like half a day of working. That's when I started going to school and did other things. I had plenty of time. And the people, I have to say, at the time were very, very welcoming. I mean, you know, they say, oh, you come from a great country with so much culture, you know. So I say, wow. I talk to the people in France. I left. They say, what are you doing there? They don't even have bread. They don't have wine. They don't have cheese, you know, at the time. But, people were extremely welcoming here. So I loved it. Things went on, one thing after another, and I'm still here.
But the thing is, you come here, and you're at Pavillon for how long?
I was at the Pavillon not too long, from September until next April, 6-7 months. At that time, there was problem with Soule, the owner, and all kind of problem with the employee and Pierre Frenet, who was the executive chef. And he had come with Soule in 1939 for the World's Fair as a young commis, and he stayed there eventually. He was the executive chef when I was there. Had problem with Soule, and he decided to leave. And coincidentally, at that time, Howard D. Johnson, who created Howard Johnson, was a regular patron of the Pavillon. So he hired Pierre, and Pierre told me, you want to come with me? And I said, okay, great idea. So that's what happened.
Okay, let's stop there, because this is the turn that just is so amazing to me. So you hit the summit in France, you're cooking for the heads of state, you come to New York, you're at Pavillon in New York, and the Howard Johnson, the namesake of the business, comes to Pavillon. Is he a regular?
Yes, he was a regular.
Okay, so he's a regular there, and he gets you to come and cook for the Howard Johnson's restaurant chain, right? Correct?
Yes, absolutely.
How the hell did he do that? How did he get you to come?
No, he actually asked Pierre to come, and Pierre decided to go, and Pierre told me, you want to come with me to assist me and do, and that's how I did. But the point is that, as I said, the cook was quite different than now, because on that spring of 1960, I was offered the job at the White House for Kennedy. But I had done that, as I said, in France. I'd never been on a magazine, newspaper. So I had no idea of the potential for publicity, too, because it really did not exist. In fact, the one who went to the White House, René Verdon, was a friend of mine who was the sous chef at the Essex House in New York. And I called him, put them in touch, eventually got the job. And a year later, he sent me a picture of him with President Kennedy or Mrs. Kennedy. I said, wow, I never had a picture with De Gaulle or something
like that. Right.
So it was already changing a different world. But prior to him, who was the chef at the White House? I asked, and it ended up knowing that it was a black lady from the South somewhere. No one would have known her name, no more than they knew my name or whatever. So it was a different world. We have to look at it in that context. And Howard Johnson was another world for me. American eating, American habit.
Well, that's what I want to ask you, which is when you come here, again, head of state, France, Pavillon, you get offered the White House job. What's the first thing? You're in New York, correct? You settle in New York first. What's the first thing that strikes you about the way Americans eat in American restaurants?
Well, I live on 50th between 1st and 2nd Avenue, on top of a little restaurant called La Toque Blanche near a certain place, a very nice area. So there was a supermarket which opened, my first supermarket. I thought it was great. I didn't have to go to the fish guy, the vegetable guy, and so forth. But then there was a lot of package. Then there was some good meat, beef, lamb, even lobster. But there was only one salad, that was iceberg. There was no leek, no shallot, no oriental vegetable. I remember saying, what are the mushrooms? They say, aisle 5. That was canned mushroom there. You didn't have any. So it was another world, you know, in terms. Of course, at the Pavillon, we had great supplier, even from Europe, from different parts, for the fish and all that, too. But yes, it certainly, it was different.
So in France, it's very compartmentalized. You go to the fish market, you go to the butcher, you go to the vegetable place. It's all separate. The bakery, everything is separate. Now, I mean, I can only say this because it's true, and that is that, for me, Howard Johnson's occupied a very specific place, because as a Catholic in the 60s, as a child, we couldn't eat meat on Friday. So the Howard Johnson's fish fry on Fridays was a staple in my house, going to have the coleslaw and the hush puppies and the corn or whatever it was.
And
you know, fried clams. But Howard Johnson's, for the guy that's a restless guy, for the guy that's moving around and trying things, you stay with Howard Johnson's for 10 years, is that correct?
Right, yes.
Why?
Well, to start with, Howard D. Johnson, the father, came to my wedding, he came to the christening of my daughter. So they were from, he used to come to the commissary, and Pierre Frenet and he said, okay, you guys do whatever you want. So we start changing butter instead of margarine, fresh onion instead of dehydrated onion. We start changing all the recipe and start working in the kitchen with four chicken to do a chicken pot pie. And we end up with 3,000 pounds of chicken at the time. You know, I move on the 1,000-gallon kettle. So it was a large production. You know, when I finish Howard Johnson, I opened a restaurant on Fifth Avenue called La Potagerie in New York. We serve only soup. Then I was a consultant for the World Trade Center for Joe Baum. We serve 130,000 people a day. I was a consultant at the Russian Tea Room. I'm saying only that because other French chefs, I would never have been able to do any of those jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know anything about production, marketing, chemistry of food. So Howard Johnson was a good experience for me. I learned a lot.
The book is Le Technique. So the technique is as important to you as the artistry. Preparing food in a certain way, because you've mentioned repeatedly in interviews, programs of yours, and in your writing about your mindfulness about economics in cooking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't waste anything.
Yeah, economic of motion as well as economic of food and so forth. And La Technique, I published La Technique, I think in 74 or 5. It's still in print. I don't cook the same way that I cooked 50 years ago or two. But the way you sharpen a knife, peel an asparagus, poach an egg is the same way. So those book of technique kind of remain because of that.
Chef Jacques Pepin. If you enjoy in-depth culinary conversations, check out my episode with Chef Eric Repair of the legendary Le Bernardin.
What I like about Europe is the quality of the products. When they serve vegetables, they taste like what they're supposed to taste. Mm-hmm. Here is a bit of a challenge because we do not cultivate the same way. You know, like the soil is maybe not the same. I don't know. Like an artichoke in the Mediterranean is not the same artichoke that we eat here. And, you know, it's like those gigantic farms and they have ways of cultivating and maximizing the land and
factory.
So on. It's factories. The artichokes are grown.
To hear more of my conversation with Eric Repair, go to heresthething.org. After the break, Jacques Pepin tells us where a world-famous chef dines in his downtime.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Jacques Pepin's culinary techniques, everyday cooking, and heart and soul in the kitchen, these are just a few of the many television programs Pepin has created to instruct the home chef. But of all his work as a television icon, one series he is most well known for is his Emmy-winning show with Julia Child, Julia and Jacques, Cooking at Home.
When I did a series with Julia Child, you know, we did, I knew her 50 years. You know, I met her in 1960. So we did the series together. We had no recipe. She said, what do you want to do? Just write down 100 things of you want to do. We did 26 shows. And she did the same way. And I think three of mine made it in the show. You know, we cooked together without recipes, so it was harder for the cameraman, of course. They don't know whether we're going to go left, right, or whatever. But for me, I have a scallion in that dish because they happen to be on the table, so I throw them in. Much easier to work without recipe, just testing, adjusting this. And the second thing, when we did our show, of course, on PBS, you have a time frame. The show is 30 minutes. They say, don't go over time. It's too expensive. But Julia said, we'll cook, and when it finished, we'll tell you. Some of the show were 80 minutes, 90 minutes. I mean, it was amazing. Right. You know, and then, so we had wine. We had good wine. We had no recipe, and we had as much time as we wanted. So it's fun cooking.
I watched that documentary about her, and I was enthralled by that film. It really was a magical, an opportunity to really get to know somebody you thought you knew.
Yes.
A woman who everybody in this country knew who she was, I mean, at least of my generation, but you really didn't know her. And when you got to know her, it was really, really a wonderful film.
Well, she was exactly the same way in person that she was on television. I mean.
Now, so when you're in the United States and you come here and before you go to Pavillon, and this speaks to also just your patterns throughout your life, whether you're in Europe or what have you, do you like to go to restaurants? Do you enjoy eating out? Or do you much more prefer to just cook at home? Do you dine out with any regularity or you prefer not to?
Both. I mean, I love to cook at home with friends occasionally. We did last night. But otherwise, I love to go to a restaurant, of course. I mean, usually pretty straightforward restaurant. For example, for American, in the psyche of American, I believe a lot, French cooking is understood in the context of a Michelin star. You know, well, there is 12 or 14 three-star Michelin in France. There's about 70, 80 two-star and about 400 one-star. The whole star system of the Michelin is about 600 restaurants, where there is 168,000 restaurants in France. All the restaurants that I was talking about, my mother, too, many of them had never been a three-star restaurant in a Michelin guide. I'm saying that because in the psyche of the American people, often they look at French cooking in the context of Michelin, very elegant and famous.
Yeah. High-stakes dining, yeah.
Which is not really, it's part of it, but a small part to a certain extent.
Now, for you, when you dine out, what's the first thing that you look for in a restaurant that you find attractive?
What? To a certain extent, the service. I mean, you know, you get into a restaurant or you're on the road, you get into a restaurant, you go in just looking at the bottom of the chair or the table, whether they are clean or not, the smell of the restaurant and all that. I say, I'm staying or I'm not staying here. Yeah. I'm not talking about famous restaurants. So there is that first impression, which is very important. And the way you receive the service too. Yeah, those first impressions are very important, I think, in the restaurant. I mean, I used to review a fair amount of restaurants with Craig Claiborne at the New York Times because I knew Craig, again, when I came to this country, I mean, through the Pavillon. Again, so very often it's a job that I would not have. In fact, I was proposed the job after he left and died. I mean, that would you be interested? I couldn't do that. I mean, it's very easy. I can tell you 15 things wrong anywhere that you go, but this is not my type of thing. And after, I know I would have been pretty bored and frustrated after, a couple of weeks on the job.
Well, for me, my wife and I, we go out to dinner probably, you know, four nights a week because it's the only time I have my wife to myself.
Right.
We have to put all the kids to bed. And I go to dinner with my wife, and my feeling about restaurants is, you know, we basically try new things every now and then. Someone will say, oh, you must go here. Yeah. But we go to the same four places over and over again. I want reliability. I walk in that restaurant, I know exactly what I'm going to get.
Right. Me too. If I go to a place where they do a fantastic roast chicken, I want to go back there. And if I go back there and they say, we don't do it anymore, I say, what's going on? I mean, you know, I had, you know, there's so many 23,000, 24,000 restaurants in New York. The amount of ethnicity and the choice is unmatched anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. When you find six or eight restaurants that you can rely on if you want Chinese or this and that, yeah, of course you go back there. That's what you want. And you want the same food.
Now, are there things you won't eat Or did your training put you in a place where you eat anything?
Yeah. Yes. I'm a glutton, basically. Yes. I eat anything you put in front of me.
Really?
Yes. I mean, I don't really think of many things that I don't like. It changed. I mean, your metabolism changed. At my age, I used to love a large steak. Now, if I have a steak, if I have 2 or 3 ounces, a piece of that, that's more than enough.
Right.
So, you know, things change. I eat probably more soup than I ever did and other things like that. The way you cook, when you're a young chef, often you add to the plate, you add to the plate, you add to the plate too, mm-hmm. presentation too. And when you get to be a certain age, if I have a great tomato out of my garden, at the right temperature, you know, a bit of salt, it's ripe, a bit of salt, a bit of olive oil on top, I don't need more embellishment on the plate. So I take away from the plate to be left with something more essential. Not my age, but it's a normal progression with age and so forth.
I mean, beyond, I want to say this carefully because I don't want to say the wrong thing here, but it's like beyond drugs and alcohol and things that have a grip on people in this very, very powerful way, beyond that, there's nothing that has a control of people more than food.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Food is the most powerful reality in our lives.
There is nothing also who bring people together like food. You know, you sit down at the table with people you don't know to all of a sudden, you know, you start having conversation and all that. You may be sitting next to the governor on one side and maybe the dishwasher of the restaurant. Yeah. On the other side. But it really doesn't matter. I remember traveling in the northern of Europe and Yugoslavia and so forth in little village many, many years ago. People look behind their curtain, foreigners, you know. I mean, you're dangerous, you're foreigner. You sit at the bistro and you order by hand. If you don't know the language, you get the bottle of wine there and whatever bread too. And all of a sudden, people sit around you know, they look at you, you send them a bottle of wine, and an hour later, you're speaking unknown language with those people because you're, quote, normal. You know, you eat like them or so forth. So food is very important. One of the most important things for me is probably to follow the season. You know, I mean, the supermarkets seem to be greater and more beautiful they've ever been. You have strawberry year-round, but when you test it and when you go to a farm, buy a basket of strawberry in full season, you can see the difference.
Sure.
So it changed. So it seemed to be very plentiful in some ways, but it's not. I mean, following the season is the best thing you can do. That's when a tomato really tastes good, full season. Mm. That's when it's really cheap, too.
Right.
And when nutritionally, that's when it's the best for you. So, you know, you go to those places from the south of France to Sicily or Sardinia, where people live over 100 years old. They eat very simply, but they follow the season simply, have a glass of wine, and eat, you know, what's in season simply. And that's great.
We had Eric Ripert, obviously, from Le Bernardin here on the show about a year ago. And when he described what it was like when he was young and he was in the kitchen, it's a lot of work, boy. It sounds like it was really, really, really a lot of work.
It was, but we didn't know it was work, you know. And as I said, at that time, no recipe, the chef tell you, do this. And if you say why, he would have said, because I just told you, right? So I worked for a year in apprenticeship, cleaning the floor, and then started scaling fish, killing chicken at the time. We killed chicken, pluck chicken, rabbit, scaling fish too, without just by looking and doing it. And then one day, a year later, the chef told me, you start at the stove tomorrow. Start at the stove. I only kept close to the stove to put wood and coal in it. At that point, there was no. And I work at the stove and I knew how to do it through osmosis, you know, at that time, the repeat and so forth. So that was a different way of learning as we do now. You know, I've been dean at the French Culinary Institute in New York for 25 years and I teach at BU for 43 years, I think. Mm. So now you teach totally differently. The key first are usually coming from not only high school, but often college. So they want to know more, totally different than the way I was taught when I was 13, 14. Do this, do that, that's it. You know?
Going back to when you were talking about a great tomato, what you see is I live on Long Island in the summer. We're out there for the summer, my family. And these farmers markets where it seems like people will pay just about anything to have a basket of something of the season. We have a garden in our house. We have a woman who comes, she prepares the garden, and then she texts me and says, here's what's ready to pick. The Japanese eggplant is ready to pick. The flowers are ready to pick. We've got a decent-sized garden. And my family, I got seven kids. My wife and I are some people who help us. We can't eat everything that comes out of that garden.
I know. I did two soups this summer with cucumber. I had so much. I peeled it, took the seed out of it, put it in the food processor, emulsify it, salt, pepper, and I mix that with the Bloody Mary mix, very spicy cucumber. I had a gazpacho right there.
Right.
And I did another one the same way, but then mix it with yogurt and mint to do yogurt soup during the summer. So often the recipe come from that overabundance of things that you have.
Chef Jacques Pepin, if you're enjoying this conversation, tell a friend. And be sure to follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Jacques Pepin shares how a near-fatal car accident changed the course of his life.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep experts. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, "We are going to give women meaningful beauty." And I said, "That's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life."
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Chef Jacques Pepin's career boasts a seemingly endless list of accomplishments, from cooking for multiple heads of state to creating the culinary certificate program at Boston University. That's why I wanted to know why he chose to go back to school, earning his bachelor's and master's degrees from Columbia University in his adulthood.
Well, to start with, I left school when I was 13 years old. So there was always, often in the kitchen, that complex about not having an education, you know, and all that. So I saw that even, as I said, when I was at Howard Johnson, for example, I was with Pierre Frenet. Pierre Frenet was a fantastic chef, great guy. He started working like I did, but he never went back to college after he was here. And I remember Mr. Johnson Junior there, who was at Cornell, he used to come with his other kid, the same age, 22, 23. They come out of college, and I know that Pierre was impressed. He didn't know what to do. When, in fact, they knew nothing about cooking or anything. At that time, I was already in the graduate school at Columbia, so I wasn't impressed by them. So it changed your mentality, you know. As I said, one time I gave the commencement address at Columbia, actually, and I said a quote, I think, from Somerset Maugham, which the education is very important. Without an education, you're likely to fall in the deadly danger of taking educated people seriously. So it's true. To a certain extent, you know, I would never have been able to do everything that I've done without the education I get at Columbia. And I went to Columbia from 1959 to 1973. 73, I proposed a doctoral dissertation on an history of food in the context civilization literature. And at that time, they told me, are you crazy? Food? No, we cannot accept that. So they refused. So I left.
That's crazy. But
actually, I went to BU.
And you got your doctorate there?
Yeah. Columbia still gave me a PhD later. I think it's another world, the world of food now. I mean, the way we get respect and all that. And I have to say that American chefs start later than what it used to be, 13 years old in Europe and so forth. So they usually go to school too. They are more educated too. So it's a different business. They get much more into business now. So many chefs that I know from Daniel Boulou have 6, 7, 8 restaurants. I never did that type of things. I don't think that I would have been very good at that. I'm not very good at business in general. So, the chef now is a much more larger person than it used to be.
So, a couple quick things that I want to touch on. So, you were in a very serious car accident.
Yes.
And this was back in what year?
1974. You know, I tried to avoid a deer fall in a ravine tree, and I had 12, 14 fractures. You know, broke my back in 3 places, my 2 hip, leg, arm. They thought that I wouldn't live. They thought that I wouldn't walk again. And in fact, one of the first things my wife signed, remove out of the left arm. The left arm, there was only pieces. Good thing they didn't cut it off. So that kind of changed my life too. It pushed me in the direction of writing about food. Mm-hmm. You know, I did for the New York Times.
You couldn't stand in the kitchen for very long, obviously.
Well, I can, but you know, not like 12 hours a day, all the time, every day, 6 hours. It's pretty taxing, you know.
Yeah, so, no, of course.
Yeah, so that changed my life.
That changed your life in an important way. I want you to mention 2 things. Your new cookbook is called what?
Cooking My Way, I think. You know, I did 13 series of PBS show, and each time there is a theme. So each time you have a book with a different theme, and that's why I have so many books. I even did a book for the Cleveland Clinic for cardiac patients, weight loss. So you put your knowledge of food toward a very specific area. In the New York Times for 8-10 years, I had a column called The Purposeful Cook, which was to cook for a family of 6 for a minimal amount of money. So the idea was economy in the kitchen. So this is a bit of the same theme that I took back here. You know, but I've been very lucky with all of the books that I've done and with PBS and so forth. So
you've had an amazingly broad career. It's incredible.
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
Which brings me to, you said you just turned 88?
Yeah, yesterday.
So yesterday was your birthday. You're 88, which means, and I have many friends, and many friends who are older than I am. I'm 65, and my friends who are in their late 70s and rounding the corner toward 80, who have great careers, they're like, they're never going to retire. They're like, well, this is who I am. This is what I do. Retirement is death to them.
Are you kidding? If you love what you're doing, you never have to go to work.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, one more thing. Your foundation. Describe to us when you started that and what the mission of the foundation is.
Yeah, it was actually my son-in-law. My daughter does Facebook for me. My son-in-law does Instagram, all of those. He's a professor at Johnson & Well. He's actually a professional chef 40 years, but then he went back to Johnson & Well to teach and get his master and get a PhD. So at some point, about 5-6 years ago, he told me, you know, you've been teaching all your life. Who do you think you would like to teach now? So we talked about it. I said, you know, people who have been a bit disenfranchised by life, you know, people who come out of jail, you know, homeless people, former drug addict, even veterans. So I feel that in 6 weeks with the video that we are teaching and all that, in 6 weeks I could teach someone in the kitchen, if they're interested, how to peel onion properly, how to peel asparagus, how to poach an egg, and then you know the basic. And if you like it and keep at it, 5 years later, maybe you're the chef there, you know, and you're in charge now of the kitchen, and you make good money, and you kind of redo your life. Those are not necessarily young people in the organization, you know, a lot of 40, 50 people, but we work through community kitchen a bit all over the country. And it's been quite rewarding. And we need people like that in the kitchen, you know, to work.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I must say, what a great honor it is for me to meet you. It is an honor. I'm a great admirer of yours.
A great honor for me. I wanted to tell you, I have to say, yeah, my daughter and my son-in-law and my granddaughter, they love you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Happy cooking.
My thanks to Jacques Pepin. More information about the Jacques Pepin Foundation
can be found at jp.foundation. This episode was recorded at CDM Studios in New York City. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Zach McNeese, and Maureen Hoban. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Our social media manager is Danielle Gingrich. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.